Palin needed to get on top of international affairs. The trouble was, the outside world kept intruding. The McCain people knew so little about Palin that every time a press controversy erupted, someone had to race to the suite and find out directly from her what was true and what was false. Palin had barely settled in on Sunday night before she had to deal with drafting the statement concerning Bristol's pregnancy. Palin called her daughter in Alaska to tell her the revelation was coming. "I love you," she reassured Bristol. "You're a good person." Then turned to her fledgling team and said, "All business. Where were we?" By and large, Palin's reaction to the parade of controversies traipsing through her suite was a blend of equanimity, steely focus, and naivete. Watching cable, she would point to some famous personality spouting one of the stories about her and say, "Who is this person?" Palin meant it both sarcastically and literally. She was green enough to the national scene that she couldn't tell the players without a scorecard. Of all the tales she rebutted that week, only one shattered her aplomb. After Schmidt told her about the Inquirer's accusations of infidelity, she briefly lost her composure while rehearsing her speech. It was amid this bedlam that Schmidt's desired policy tutoring took place. Schooling Palin were Steve Bagan, a longtime Republican foreign policy hand, and Randy Schuneman, a McCain national security advisor. In the days since the pick, Schmidt had spent enough time with Palin to get a sense of how much instruction she would need. "You guys have a lot of work to do," he warned Schuneman. "She doesn't know anything." Schuneman and Bagan took Schmidt at his word. They sat Palin down at a table in the suite, spread out a map of the world, and proceeded to give her a potted history of foreign policy. They started with the Spanish Civil War, then moved on to World War I, World War II, the Cold War, and what Schuneman liked to call the three wars of today, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Global War on Terror. The tutorial took up most of Monday, starting early and going late. When the teacher suggested breaking for lunch or dinner, the student resisted. "No, no, 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 let's keep going," Palin said. "This is awesome." Palin was particular about her study aids. Early on, she told her team that she absorbed information best from 5x7 index cards. With Schuneman and Bagan, she became obsessive, wanting to put every pertinent piece of information, including the names of world leaders, on separate cards. Soon enough, she had multiple towering stacks of cards, which she referred to constantly, sitting quietly and poring over them, lugging them back to her room to memorize late at night. It quickly became a running joke on Team Palin, "Don't get between Sarah and her cards." Tuesday night and all of Wednesday were given over to Palin's speech, which was written by Matthew Scully, a former Bush White House wordsmith. A speech coach was imported from New York to help Palin convey her personality through the text. Wallace taught her to say, "Nuclear, not nuclear," writing out the letters for good measure, N-E-W-C-L-E-A-R. Palin worked tirelessly on her address, pounding out more than a dozen run-throughs. Tucker Eskew watched the rehearsals carefully. She was good, he could see, and she would be even better from the stage. "She's a red light on performer," he thought, "kind of like Obama." But McCain aides were still nervous as the moment of truth arrived. Palin hadn't spoken that often from teleprompters in her career, and she certainly had never experienced anything like this kind of pressure, a situation in which the stakes were so high, where everyone was watching. As Palin strode out on stage, the heebie-jeebies even overcame Eskew. "What if it's a bomb?" he thought. The roar of approval inside the hall was deafening. The faithful were resentful of a media they believed had treated the VP nominee unfairly, turning at one point toward the press seats and chanting, "Shame on you!" They wanted to be wowed by Palin, and they were. In a Shantung Valentino jacket and black skirt, Sarah was glamorous, homespun, spunky, and snarky. She bragged that when she became governor, she shed the office of its luxury jet. "I put it on eBay." She said she told the Congress thanks, but no thanks, for that bridge to nowhere. She described herself as just your average hockey mom, and threw in an ad lib that she'd used before but wasn't in her text. "You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull," she said, "lipstick." What was less expected was the delight that Palin took in baring her fangs and sinking them into Obama. "I guess a small-town mayor is sort of like a community organizer, except that you have actual responsibilities," she quipped. She said, "We tend to prefer candidates who don't talk about us one way in Scranton and another way in San Francisco." She called Obama an elitist, an egotist, a taxer, a spender, an appeaser, and an accomplishment-free zone. By the end, it was clear why that Barracuda moniker had stuck. Watching on television in a room backstage, McCain went from pacing fretfully to murmuring, "She's really good," to saying, "She's incredible," to grabbing Wallace and exulting, "Oh my God, great job, she did a great job." Then Wallace told McCain that Palin's achievement was even greater than he knew. Her prompter had been malfunctioning throughout the speech. The text hadn't paused during periods of applause, so a couple of lines were always missing from the screen when she resumed. "If that happens to me tomorrow night," McCain replied, "we're fucked." No one besides maybe Salter had high expectations for McCain's speech, but for all its shortcomings, it reflected clearly the consensus in McCain world that reviving the candidate's independent, cross-partisan image was essential. The only time that McCain uttered the surname Bush was when he was referring to Laura. Only thrice did he use the word Republican, once in relation to Palin, and twice in the context of decrying corruption. But McCain's speech didn't matter. The only storyline out of St. Paul was Palin mania. Some armchair GOP psychologists had surmised initially that the reason McCain picked Palin was that he didn't want to be overshadowed by his running mate. But for the next week, as the two of them campaigned together across the country, they were greeted by massive, beaming crowds who were there mainly to see her. And McCain loved it. Everywhere they went, Palin described McCain as the one great man in the race as he grinned from ear to ear. "Change is coming, my friends," McCain crowed over and over. Donations and volunteers spiked up. Cable and radio could talk of little else but Sarah. The Palin pick deprived Obama of his post-convention bump. The weekend after the GOP convention, McCain was trailing him by a trifling 2 points, and according to an ABC News Washington Post poll, McCain's standing among white women had improved by a net 20 points, from 50 to 42 behind Obama to 53 to 41 ahead, in the blink of an eye. On September 10th, McCain and Palin appeared together in Fairfax, Virginia, a few miles from the campaign's headquarters. 15,000 people swarmed into Van Dyke Park, little girls wearing "Strong Women Vote McCain-Palin" t-shirts, their mothers chanting, "Sarah, Sarah, Sarah." Later that afternoon, Palin would board a flight to Alaska for her interview with Gibson. At the moment, though, she stood there on stage, perched atop a pair of ruby-red heels, looking less like Eliza Doolittle than Dorothy, the girl swept up in the cyclone, lifted out of her black-and-white world, and deposited in a Technicolor Oz. Obama and his people certainly felt as though a house had been dropped on their heads. Since the moment Palin's selection was announced, they had been struggling to calibrate a response to her and the variables she injected into the campaign. In Palin, the Obamans were confronting something with which they had no experience, a phenomenon so new and fascinating to the press and public that it eclipsed even their boss. For the first time, they understood how the Hillary landers felt during much of the Democratic nomination fight, helpless, flummoxed, unable to break through. In the hours after the announcement, Team Obama turned to Hillary herself for help, asking her to put out a tough statement criticizing the pick as a transparent ploy that female voters would see right through. Clinton not only declined to do that, but she did the opposite, calling Palin's nomination historic and saying that Palin would add an important new voice to the debate. Hillary had no intention of assisting in the trashing of Palin. She thought it would annoy her supporters. She also believed the pick might prove to be smart politics, and in this she was seconded by her husband. When Democratic elites initially scoffed at Palin, ridiculing her outré tastes, the passion for weaponry, the hankering for moose burgers, Bill Clinton went into Bubba mode, cautioning them not to underestimate her appeal. "Don't be so sure of yourselves," he said. "Good old boys, they can relate to her." The reaction of the Democratic establishment to Palin was wildly schizophrenic. In the days just after she burst on the scene, she was discounted as just a pretty face, and McCain was mocked for having squandered his only argument against Obama, experience, and disqualified himself with a nakedly political pick. But as Palin mania built over the week following the Republican convention, panic spread through the Democratic ranks. The Obamans were swamped with phone calls and email from donors, operatives, and members of Congress demanding that Palin be taken down, slamming the campaign for being too soft and passive, urging them to do something. Team Obama was split over how to handle the Palin perplex. On one side were advisors convinced she would inevitably self-destruct. On the other were those who shared what Plouffe described as the bedwetting tendencies of much of the establishment. One member of the campaign's media team, Steve Murphy, referred to Palin as a Republican female Barack Obama. In focus groups, voters were split roughly into thirds, those who dismissed her out of hand, those who weren't sure what to think, and those who found her a breath of fresh air. She is the change that Barack Obama talks about, said one voter in the latter camp. Obama attempted to retain his balance through the outbreak of Palin mania. When his team's first instinct was to criticize Palin's selection, he dialed them back. He counseled them repeatedly to keep their eyes and train their fire on the top of the ticket. When Jarrett informed him of a series of meetings she'd had in New York with frantic Democrats in that first week after the conventions, Obama said, "Just tell them to calm down." A couple of days later, Jarrett received a viral email that pictured Obama staring forward sternly and pointing in the direction of the camera. Above his head were the words, "Everyone chill the fuck out," and below that the message, "I got this." She forwarded it to Obama. "That's what I was trying to tell you," Obama replied. Yet Palin mania and the media dynamics it unleashed were a quantum force that even the Democratic nominee could not resist entirely. The day before Palin set off back to Alaska, Obama was in Virginia too, and he offered an observation about McCain's new message of change. "I guess his whole angle is, watch out, George Bush. Except for economic policy, health care policy, tax policy, education policy, foreign policy, and Karl Rove-style politics, we're really going to shake things up in Washington," he said at a rally. "That's not change, that's just calling something that's the same thing something different. You know, you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig." The McCain campaign was perfectly aware that Obama was making no allusion to Palin's lipstick on a pit bull convention line. The lipstick on a pig phrase was common parlance, particularly in politics. But the team saw a celeb-like chance to clog up the cable airwaves, harness the right-wing freak show to its advantage, and keep Obama and his people on defense. Within hours, McCain World accused Obama of referring to Palin as a pig and demanded an apology, and the story exploded as planned. Obama's frustration with the media was intense, but the next day, he felt he had no choice but to respond by calling for an end to the absurdity, even as he fueled both it and the dominance of Palin in the campaign discourse for another day. All through the campaign, in moments of annoyance at its triviality, Obama would tell Axelrod that when it was over, he planned to write a book entitled "This is Ridiculous," and the lipstick on a pig imbroglio was definitely that. But there was no denying one brute reality. A week after the conventions, McCain had pulled even in the polls again. Some even had him a little bit ahead. Obama smirked and reprised for Axelrod another of his favorite sayings, "This shit would be really interesting if we weren't in the middle of it." Chapter 21, September Surprise. Obama showed up at Axelrod's office wearing jeans, a leather jacket, and his White Sox cap. It was September 14th, a rainy Sunday afternoon in Chicago, and Axelrod had called a small Circle the Wagons meeting to talk about how to turn things around after 10 solid days of pounding. The candidate wasn't supposed to be there, but when he heard about the meeting, Obama decided to hijack it. He had just gotten word that the apocalypse was nigh. He began by letting his people know that he wasn't entirely happy. Since the Republican convention, his campaign had been too much on its back foot, was playing subpar ball. The ads, the strategy, the tactics, all of it needed to be stronger. The first of his three debates with McCain was less than 2 weeks away in Oxford, Mississippi. "I've got to perform," he said, "but we've all got to sharpen our message." Obama thought the campaign needed to be more forceful and pointed in offering a contrast with McCain on the economy and shift the focus away from Palin. Larry Grisolano had come to the meeting pushing a proposal, two-minute TV ads with Obama addressing the camera directly, laying out his economic agenda. Obama immediately approved it. The American economy had been in recession since the end of 2007. Driven there by the collapse of the mid-decade housing bubble and the subprime mortgage market. By September, the financial system had spiraled into an ever-deepening crisis as one venerable institution after another buckled under crushing losses. The investment bank Bear Stearns had gone belly up in March. Merrill Lynch and the insurance titan AIG were imploding. The federal government had just seized control of the foundering mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And now Lehman Brothers, one of Wall Street's most storied firms, was on the brink of bankruptcy. Financial economics was hardly an area of expertise for Obama, nor had he said much about the unfolding crisis during the campaign. But behind the scenes, he was building relationships with a handful of influential financial figures, a former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, former SEC Chairman William Donaldson, and UBS America's Chairman Robert Wolf, who was one of Obama's most prodigious fundraisers and had become his go-to guy on questions involving the money markets. Over the weekend of September 13th and 14th, Wolf was among a clique of bankers and policymakers, including Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, locked in a marathon meeting at the New York Fed, wrestling with the fate of Lehman. Every so often, Wolf would step out and phone Obama with status reports. Obama was also in touch with Paulson, to whom he'd started to reach out as the crisis worsened. By Sunday, the picture that Wolf and Paulson were painting wasn't pretty. Lehman was likely to go under the next morning, with potentially calamitous fallout on Wall Street and stock markets around the world. At the meeting in Axelrod's office, Obama revealed nothing specific about what he was hearing, but he told the room that an event might be coming overnight that would change the political landscape dramatically, turning the final 2 months of the campaign into an all-economics, all-the-time affair. "If this event happens, the country may be in for a bad stretch," he said. "We're going to have to deal with it in some way because the impact could be devastating. I told Paulson that we'd be cooperative and try to help out the administration. We're not going to mess around playing politics. In any case, the right politics here, I think, is to behave responsibly." Obama knew that economic issues favored the Democratic side in the campaign, but these external forces were too unpredictable for comfort, especially with the race so close and the Palin surge still in effect. Obama's confidence wasn't shaken, but his voice betrayed concern. "It's a very volatile situation," he said. "We could still lose this thing." The next morning, Lehman announced it was seeking Chapter 11 protection after the government declined to intercede to save the firm. The filing set in motion the largest bankruptcy in American history. It triggered a financial panic that would provide Obama and McCain with a real-time test of political temperament, skill, and leadership. And it marked the start of an extraordinary 10-day period that would more or less decide the election. McCain greeted the day of Lehman's demise at a rally in Jacksonville, Florida. The Dow was already plunging its way toward a 500-point decline between the opening and closing bells. "There's been tremendous turmoil in our financial markets and Wall Street, and it is... people are frightened by these events," McCain said. "The fundamentals of our economy are strong, but these are very, very difficult times." In his maladroit way, McCain was trying to heed the advice of his chief economic advisor, Douglas Holtz-Eakin, who had counseled him not to talk down the economy and assured him that its underlying strength, its workers, its factories, was intact. McCain, indeed, had uttered the same line before, and it had gone unnoticed, but in the context of Lehman, fundamentals was a gaffe of historic proportions. Matters fiscal and monetary were always the weakest policy link for McCain, which he admitted publicly more than once. Holtz-Eakin begged him to please stop saying that aloud, particularly in light of its truth, but there was no hiding McCain's rudderlessness over the next 3 days as he lurched from blunder to blunder. On Tuesday, McCain declared the financial situation a total crisis, an effort to clean up the fundamentals mess that instead looked like an abrupt about-face. That same day, he stated his adamant opposition to a proposed federal bailout of AIG. The next morning, after the bailout had been announced, he flipped to reluctantly supporting it. The day after that, he attacked SEC Chairman Chris Cox, saying, "If I were president today, I would fire him," only to have it pointed out that no president, real or hypothetical, has that power. Making an awful week worse, one of McCain's main economic surrogates, former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Farina, went on NBC and observed, "I don't think John McCain could run a major corporation." With that, Fiorina provoked an unnamed McCain advisor to give to CNN.com one of the priceless blind quotes of 2008. Carly will now disappear. The Obamans could barely contain their glee. Their boss's reaction shifted quickly from incredulity to disdain. When he first heard about fundamentals, Obama said to Axelrod, "Why did he say that?" 3 days later, after the Chris Cox episode, a friend emailed Obama asking what he thought explained McCain's wild swings and oscillations. "No fucking discipline," Obama replied. As McCain bumbled publicly, Obama was privately conducting for himself what amounted to an on-the-fly series of postgraduate seminars, holding lengthy conference calls night and day with his party's brainiest economic savants. Many of the people to whom Obama turned were Clinton veterans, former Treasury Secretaries Bob Rubin and Larry Summers, former Council of Economic Advisers Chief Laura Tyson. Obama also turned to Clinton himself, calling the former president several times, soliciting his advice, impressing him for the first time, really, with his approach to the crisis. Obama was talking regularly with Fed Chair Ben Bernanke and daily, sometimes more often, with Paulson. The Treasury Secretary was astonished by the candidate's level of engagement. On one occasion, Obama kept his plane on the tarmac for a half hour after the final event of his day, with a long flight ahead of him so he could finish a conversation with Paulson. On another, Obama called Paulson late at night at home and spent 2 hours discussing the intricate details of regulatory reform. As much as the substantiveness of the discussion struck Paulson, so did their sobriety and maturity. "I'll be there publicly for you at any time," Obama told him. "I'm going to be president, and I don't want to inherit a financial system that's collapsed." McCain was in communication with Bernanke and Paulson, too, but to less useful effect. In one exchange with the Fed chairman, McCain compared the causes of the crisis to some recent management troubles at Home Depot. "It's kind of like that, isn't it?" he asked Bernanke. "No, it's not," a flabbergasted Bernanke replied. When Paulson tried to get McCain on the phone urgently, it would often take a day for his messages to be returned, and even then it might be Lindsey Graham on the other end of the line instead of the candidate. At one point, McCain insisted on putting Palin on a call with Paulson, whereupon she proceeded to spout an assortment of populist anti-Wall Street bromides that the secretary, a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, found weirdly off-key and completely pointless. In the wake of Lehman and AIG, the credit markets were frozen shut and the capital markets in disarray. Paulson and Bernanke convinced Bush that a gargantuan bailout fund was necessary to stave off disaster. The administration in turn gave Paulson the lead in devising and selling the idea to Congress. It had little choice. The White House had no credibility on the economy, no competence to fashion complex financial transactions, and no ability to deal with the Democrats who controlled Capitol Hill. Paulson, who had spent much of his time in office reaching out across the partisan aisle, had each of those virtues. Bush and his people viewed Paulson, said one, as our Petraeus on the economy. On September 19th, Paulson and Bernanke held an emergency meeting in Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office with a bipartisan clutch of congressional leaders. Paulson argued that without quick and momentous action, economic Armageddon would ensue. Bernanke was visibly shaking, his voice trembling when he spoke. The leadership agreed to move rapidly on a bailout bill. 2 days later, Paulson presented his proposal to Congress, a 3-page request for $700 billion with essentially no strings attached. Both parties recoiled from the plan, but their respective leaders began trying to build a workable bill around it. Pelosi made it clear that House Democrats wouldn't support the bill without a substantial number of Republican votes to protect the Democrats if public opinion turned against it. John Boehner, the House Minority Leader, was on board, but after a meeting of the House Republicans on Tuesday, September 23rd, it was evident to Boehner that there was no support among his people for anything that resembled the Paulson plan. The next day, the point was reinforced when, in a private meeting, House Republicans hooted down Dick Cheney, who had come to the Hill to sell the bill. As the nature and dimensions of the dilemma became stark, all eyes in the Capitol shifted to McCain. The new conventional wisdom was that if the Republican nominee supported the bill, his party would rally around him and it would pass. If he didn't, the bill was doomed. Democrats said so, Republicans said so, the media said so. The question was, what was McCain thinking? And for the moment, he wasn't saying. McCain was twitchy that Wednesday morning as he and his senior lieutenants filed into his suite at the Hilton in Midtown Manhattan. McCain had a jam-packed schedule in New York for the next 24 hours, debate prep, an appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman, a speech at the annual meeting of the Clinton Global Initiative. But McCain was fixated on other things. Obama had phoned him an hour earlier. He'd missed the call, had no idea what it was about, and that unsettled him. And then there was the financial crisis, which he was sure would be the death of his campaign. Earlier that morning, McCain had met with 13 Republican CEOs and Wall Street tycoons, including Steve Schwarzman of the Blackstone Group, Henry Kravis of KKR, John Thain of Merrill Lynch, and Jimmy Lee of J.P. Morgan Chase, who were, at least nominally, economic advisors to his campaign. Almost to a person, their view of the severity of the crisis was identical to Paulson's, and despite their free market pedigrees, so was their conviction that a massive government intervention was required, and pronto, to keep the world from self-immolating. Up in the suite, the fog of pessimism, both economic and political, was thick as porridge. For the next several hours, McCain and his advisors grappled with how to respond to the Paulson plan and to the crisis more broadly. In other circumstances, a massive federal bailout bill would be the kind of thing McCain would oppose on instinct and on principle, and he knew that many grassroots Republicans were against it. Yet from the rambling, chaotic conversation, agreement emerged on three interlocking points that suggested a different course. First, if what they'd just heard from the financial hotshots was to be believed, the risk of an imminent global meltdown unless the government acted was high. Second, the Paulson plan didn't have the votes to pass. And third, if the bill went down and the economy cratered, Republicans, and McCain in particular, would be blamed and the election over. Checkmate, said Schmidt. Presidential campaigns are routinely consumed with faux existential crises, but this was a real one. Casting about for salvation, McCain briefly latched on to the idea of joining forces with Senator Clinton on a piece of legislation she'd introduced to ameliorate the epidemic of foreclosures that were plaguing the housing market. Impulsively, McCain grabbed his cell phone and called her. 2 minutes later, he hung up and told the group, "She doesn't want to do it." To Schmidt, Davis, and Salter, there seemed only one plausible route to survival. McCain had to fly to Washington and stitch together a passable bill. Schmidt pointed out that Harry Reid had been quoted the previous day saying, "We need the Republican nominee for president to let us know where he stands and what we should do." The ball was being handed to McCain, Schmidt said. He should take it and run for daylight, not only steaming into the Capitol to save capitalism, but suspending his campaign, pulling his ads from the air, and calling for the first debate to be postponed until an agreement on the bailout had been brokered. "It's a big risk," McCain mused. "It's a big gamble," but gradually he warmed to the notion. McCain's instinct when he saw a problem was to charge straight at it and try to solve it. He started thinking, "I can do this. I can cut this deal." In the early afternoon, with no final decision made, Team McCain headed to the Morgan Library and Museum on Madison Avenue for McCain's debate prep session. His maiden face-off with Obama was set to take place 2 days later, but this was to be McCain's first full dress rehearsal. The campaign had built a mock-up stage and had camera crews in place to document the proceedings. Former Ohio Congressman Rob Portman was on hand to play Obama. McCain was grouchy about the prep session from the get-go. When his aides tried to do a formal introduction of the candidates, McCain snapped, "We don't need to worry about that crap. It's just bullshit. I'm here at the podium. Let's just do the debate." But they didn't get too far. The interruptions were ceaseless as McCain's aides scrambled to figure out the details of how the campaign suspension might work. Finally, Schmidt interrupted and told McCain that they needed to decide. "Are we doing this?" he asked. Charlie Black and Brett O'Donnell, McCain's debate coach, had doubts about pulling out of the showdown in Oxford. "If you say you're not going to do the debate and then end up doing it," they argued, "you're going to look like a fool." But McCain brushed them off. Convinced that the gamble was worth it, he was all in. McCain set off back to the Hilton. In the car, he called Bush and informed him of his decision and asked if the president would host a meeting at the White House for him, Obama, and congressional leaders to discuss the bailout bill. Bush feared such a meeting would inject a destabilizing dose of politics into a fragile situation. He told McCain that his intercession would undercut Paulson and wasn't likely to help solve the problem. After hanging up, Bush instructed his aides, "Find out what's going on here." But before they had a chance, McCain was on TV, standing at a lectern at the Hilton, announcing the suspension and calling on Bush to convene a conclave. McCain also phoned Obama before making his announcement, finally returning his rival's call from 6 hours earlier. Obama, in Florida, doing his own debate prep, told McCain he thought that, in the spirit of bipartisanship, the two of them should release a joint statement of principles concerning the bailout. McCain replied that they should go further, get off the campaign trail and head to Washington to mediate. Obama was noncommittal, but believed that McCain had agreed to the joint statement. A few minutes later, he learned otherwise when McCain popped up on TV. "Man, that was quick," Obama said to Axelrod in disbelief. McCain had one more crucial call to place, to David Letterman. McCain had been on The Late Show a dozen times. He considered Dave a pal, but though McCain was staying overnight in New York to keep his commitment to Bill Clinton's CGI, he decided it would be in poor taste to be yucking it up in the midst of a crisis. Letterman did not take the news of the last-minute cancellation well. "He's pissed," McCain told his aides. "We'll make up." By the late afternoon, McCain finally got some good news. Bush had agreed to host the meeting. The president called Obama to extend an invitation for the following day. Obama sensed reluctance in Bush's voice, but like the president, he felt he had no real choice but to accede to McCain's wishes. The news of McCain's suspension drew gales of derision from the press. No one was willing to give him the slightest benefit of the doubt, as McCain and his people felt the media surely would have lent Obama, that his motivations were anything less than craven. Pundits said he was using the economic meltdown as an excuse to delay debating Obama. Democrats were instantaneous in criticizing McCain for disrupting the negotiations over the bill. Reid, who a day earlier had called for McCain to make his voice heard on the financial rescue, issued a statement, which he read by phone to McCain, that said, "We need leadership, not a campaign photo op." McCain World had assumed that the suspension would be viewed as an authentic, characteristic act of putting country first. But after Celeb, the selection of Palin, and Lipstick on a Pig combined with the pratfalls the week of the 15th, McCain was now seen as a typical and faintly desperate politician, and his campaign a campaign of stunts. The return to Washington might have escaped ridicule. The combination of the suspension and the move to postpone the debate was a gimmick too far. The Weasley image of McCain was reinforced that night when Letterman exacted his revenge. In the midst of acidly mocking McCain, the host discovered that he was still in New York, not racing to a plane, but preparing for an interview with CBS News' Katie Couric. Tapping into a live feed of McCain having his makeup applied on set, Letterman said, "Hey, John, I got a question. You need a ride to the airport?" As any good stuntman will attest, it's all in the execution. And in staging his return to Washington on September 25th, McCain left a great deal to be desired. There was no careful coordination with House Republicans or the White House. There was no media strategy, no plan for a press conference, nothing. McCain just showed up in his Senate office that morning and said, "Okay, let's see what I can do to get something moving here." The optics of the day were especially poor managed. A series of meetings was hastily arranged, but they were private. So, rather than images of McCain conferring with conservatives, there were shots of him wandering the halls of Congress as he moved from room to room, looking like a gypsy. He showed up in Boehner's office, where a gathering was already underway with a handful of Republican House leaders. After listening to 2.5 minutes of discussion about their concerns regarding the bill, McCain said he was on their side if it would get a deal done. Boehner and his colleagues were happy to have an ally, but they were also bemused. If House Republicans had been asked to vote for their least favorite senator in either party, McCain would likely have won in a landslide. And he, in turn, had always considered them a bunch of yahoos. McCain had only just shown up and knew next to nothing about the issues in play around the bailout, and he said not a word about how he planned to approach the meeting with the president later that day. Davis asked Boehner's chief of staff if there was anyone in his office who could staff McCain at the White House. His campaign aides were legally prohibited from doing so. A young aide named Mike Summers, who'd been in the thick of the fight over the Paulson plan, was assigned to the task. Summers rode with the nominee to the meeting, prepared to provide McCain with more detail on what House Republicans were looking for. McCain, after all, was now their de facto champion, and he was headed for the high-stakes gathering he'd requested. But McCain spent the trip down Pennsylvania Avenue talking on the phone to Cindy. "I'm on my way to the White House," he said. "What are we doing for dinner tonight?" When they arrived at their destination, McCain and Summers hopped out of the car beside the West Portico. As they walked toward the door, McCain suddenly stopped and looked at Summers blankly. "What do I need to know about this meeting?" he asked. Obama, meanwhile, had strategized extensively with Reid and Pelosi, who agreed to defer to him. Obama had no agenda to push. He was annoyed at having to be there rather than preparing for the debate. He'd resolved to show up in Oxford whether McCain did or not. "They're driving this, so let's hear what they have to say," Obama thought. Just before the meeting, Bush was briefed by his advisor, Ed Gillespie. "What's McCain going to say?" Bush asked. "We have no idea," Gillespie said. The meeting took place in the cabinet room. When the Democrats showed up en masse, Obama worked the room as if he were mayor of the White House, introducing himself and shaking hands with all the staff. McCain stood off to the side and said little. The nominees and congressional leaders took their places around the oblong mahogany table. After asking Paulson for a rundown of the situation, Bush talked about how the credit market couldn't be fixed until the political market was appeased. The president didn't care what the rescue plan looked like. "If Hank says it will work, I'm for it," he said. "Madam Speaker," Bush said, turning the floor over by protocol to Pelosi. "Mr. President, Senator Obama is going to speak for us today," Pelosi replied. "Harry," Bush said to Reid, "is Senator Obama speaking for the Senate Democrats as well?" "Yes, Mr. President, he speaks for all of us here today." Obama took the floor and held forth for 5 or 6 minutes. "I appreciate the urgency here," he said, and mentioned his regular conversations with Paulson. Obama ticked off 4 items central to the bill: executive compensation, golden parachutes, oversight, and flexibility. "I think just about everyone has agreed on these," he said, then added a sly dig at the House Republicans. "I understand there are some who may not be as far along as the rest of us." "We can argue about how we got here, but that's not the issue," Obama went on. "The issue is how to solve the problem." Boehner spoke next, airing his caucus's complaints with the Paulson plan and putting forward its smaller, less intrusive alternative. "This is interesting," Reid said, "because John Boehner seemed like he was a socialist last week, and suddenly he's finding free market principles." Pelosi and House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank piled on Boehner. Others chimed in. The pace was rapid fire, though the volume was low. At that point, Obama more or less took over. "House and Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans are ready to make this deal," Obama said. "We can't be going forward and creating a new one." One Republican in the room mused silently. If you closed your eyes and changed everyone's voices, you would have thought Obama was the President of the United States. The meeting was now more than 40 minutes old. McCain had yet to contribute. "Can I hear from Senator McCain?" Obama asked, as if he really were running the session, although he first went back to Paulson with a question. When Paulson finished, the Treasury Secretary told McCain that he'd like to hear from him, too. McCain thanked the President for hosting the gathering, then thanked Paulson. He said the situation was dire. He noted the progress has been made, but that House Republicans had concerns, which he listed. His comments sounded like introductory talking points presented as if the first 45 minutes of the meeting hadn't happened. All hell broke loose. Frank, Pelosi, and Republican Senators Richard Shelby and Mitch McConnell started loudly squabbling. Frank, agitated, turned on McCain. "John, what do you think?" Frank asked sharply. "I think the House Republicans have a right to their position," replied McCain. "Fine, you agree with that position?" "No, I just think they have a right to their position." Bush had heard enough. "You ready to end this?" he said to Reid, who signed his assent. "All right, I think I understand where we are," said Bush. "We have work to do, and all I'm asking you is to make sure we go forward." Placing his hands on the table for emphasis, he stressed how important it was that some kind of deal happen quickly. "We can't let this sucker fail," Bush said. And with that, the meeting was over. Bush was dumbfounded by McCain's behavior. He'd forced Bush to hold a meeting that the president saw as pointless, and then sat there like a bump on a log. Unconstructive, thought Bush. Unclear. Ineffectual. McCain told his aides the reason he was silent was that from the moment the Democrats deferred to Obama, he knew that the meeting would accomplish nothing. Their disruptive behavior at the end had only confirmed his opinion. To whatever extent McCain's chagrin was sincere, it reflected another bedrock miscalculation in his decision to suspend his campaign. The premise of the strategy was that McCain could return to the Capitol and play the above-the-fray bipartisan dealmaker. But in any election year, the fray is boundless. The idea that the opposition party would let McCain waltz back into Washington and stage manage a triumph with November 4th only 40 days away was folly. Yet, in the face of a determined Democratic resistance, McCain had failed even to wire the outcome on the Republican side. By the night of the White House meeting, the costs of those mistakes were apparent on every TV screen in the land, as Democrats lustily tore McCain limb from limb and Republicans were mute. "If you're going to come riding into Washington on a white horse to slay a dragon, you better have the dragon tied up and tranquilized and ready to die," a longtime friend of McCain's concluded. "You don't come in and not slay the dragon and walk out with a whimper." A bevy of Obamans were waiting in Mississippi, wondering when they might next see their man, and if he was going to end up on stage tangling with McCain or talking to himself. The next morning, less than 12 hours before the debate was scheduled to begin, the answer remained a mystery. And then, just like that, McCain's campaign issued a statement that the candidate was suddenly optimistic that there has been significant progress toward a bipartisan agreement and was therefore suspending his suspension. The jousting match was on. The topic of the first debate was supposed to have been domestic policy, per the decree of the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. But over the summer, when the two campaigns met to negotiate details, Obama's team, led by Emanuel, had proposed a switcheroo to foreign policy. For press consumption, Axelrod explained that the change reflected Obama's confidence on the topic, and that was half true. The other half, however, was that Obama believed that McCain's foreign policy strength was vastly overstated. "He doesn't know as much as everyone thinks he does," Obama told his advisors. "The surge? Check. Wasteful weapon systems? Check. Everything else? Whiff." Obama's preparation for the debates had been extensive. He was aware that his performance against Clinton had not been among his most shining moments, and he was still smarting from his one onstage encounter with McCain in August. Invited to a joint forum on social and religious issues at Rick Warren's Saddleback Church, Obama had prepared little. "Prepare? For Pastor Rick? I know this stuff." And been creamed. His answer that deciding when a fetus was entitled to human rights was above my pay grade was widely ridiculed. In the past, Axelrod had run Obama's debate prep, and it had been, like the strategist himself, disorganized and loose-limbed. For his debates with McCain, Obama had given authority to veteran Democratic strategists Tom Donilon and Ron Klain and forensic specialist Michael Sheehan, who put him through his paces with repeated dress rehearsals, DVDs of himself to study, and meticulous briefing books. For McCain, the chaotic session at the Morgan Library was not an aberration. He detested debate prep, resisted it with every fiber of his being. "Not today," was his reflexive response to the suggestion that he practice. He thought he didn't need it, thought he knew the issues, and hated being quizzed. During a rehearsal for the first GOP debate in 2007, O'Donnell pressed him on a question to the point where McCain finally snapped. "John, what is the difference between a gay marriage and a civil union?" O'Donnell asked. McCain replied, "I don't give a fuck." When he arrived that morning in Oxford, indeed, McCain had yet to complete a single formal run-through. One holdup revolved around who would play Obama in mock debates. The campaign had settled on someone it thought would be the ideal stand-in, Michael Steele, the African-American former lieutenant governor of Maryland. Not only would Steele be a feisty sparring partner, he could also help McCain become aware of potential racial rhetorical traps. Steele said yes when O'Donnell approached him and spent all summer gearing up for the task, studying Obama briefing books and watching Obama videos. But McCain stalled, worried that the press would find out he had picked a black Obama placeholder and accuse him of tokenism. After more than a month of paralysis, the idea was scrapped and Rob Portman was brought in with just 2 weeks' notice. On the afternoon of the debate, McCain was nervous. His advisors took it in stride. Charlie Black believed that if a presidential candidate said he wasn't skittish before his first general election debate, he was lying, was insane, or didn't comprehend the stakes. Perhaps Black should have added a fourth option. Freak of nature for Obama, who was as calm as ever. An hour before the debate, Valerie Jarrett went to his hotel room and knocked on the door. She was a nervous wreck. When Obama appeared, he took a look at her face, put his hand on her shoulder, and said, "Valerie, I got this." Jared headed out to the auditorium, where she met up with Michelle, who was a basket case herself. Jared told her about her exchange with Barack a few minutes earlier. "Well, then, I guess he's probably got it," Michelle said, smiling. An audience of more than 53 million watched the debate that night. They saw Obama present himself as composed and reassuring. They saw him project an aura of confidence and competence on foreign policy, and they saw him pierce McCain with one poison-tipped soundbite regarding the Republicans' record on Iraq. "You said we knew where the weapons of mass destruction were. You were wrong. You said that we were going to be greeted as liberators. You were wrong. You said that there was no history of violence between Shiite and Sunni, and you were wrong." McCain's advisors, worried that his disdain for Obama might show through, had advised their man to look at the audience and not at his opponent. He followed that directive all too well, not making eye contact with Obama all night. He seemed dismissive and cranky and ill at ease. The debate was McCain's chance to redeem himself. Instead, he spent 90 minutes reinforcing his weaknesses and doing Obama no damage. He lost every post-debate Insta-poll and was pummeled mercilessly by the cable talking heads. "Do you think he was too troll-like tonight?" Chris Matthews asked one of his guests afterward. "Seriously, do people really want to put up with 4 years of that, of him sitting there angrily, grumpily, like a codger?" The following morning, September 29th, the Paulson bailout plan was voted down in the House of Representatives, 228 to 205. Not a single Republican pulled the lever in its favor. The stock market immediately plunged nearly 800 points. 5 days later, Congress finally passed a slightly modified, but still $700 billion version of the bill. But by now, all confidence was gone. The following week, the Dow fell by almost 2,000 points, losing more than 18% of its value, the biggest weekly percentage drop in the 112-year history of the exchange. McCain and his advisors were right. The collapse of the economy hurt the GOP, but it was the performances of both candidates during those 10 September days after the fall of Lehman that mattered most. In a time of turmoil, Obama demonstrated a capacity to withstand pressure and keep his balance. The crisis atmosphere created a setting in which his intellect, self-possession, and unflappability were seen as leaderly qualities, and not as aloofness, arrogance, or bloodlessness, as they had sometimes been regarded in the past. In the Obama campaign's focus groups, doubts about his readiness began to fall away, while at the same time, voters described McCain as unsteady, impulsive, and reckless. This view was shared by Democrats and Republicans alike, by those watching the crisis unfold from afar and those with a front-row seat. Jim Wilkinson, a longtime Republican operative, served as Paulson's chief of staff during the crisis, and his impression of the candidates could hardly have been clearer. "I'm a pro-life, pro-gun Texas Republican," said Wilkinson. "I worked all 8 years for Bush. I helped sell the Iraq War. I was in the Florida recount. And I wrote a letter to John McCain asking for my $500 contribution back when he pulled that stunt and came back to D.C. because it just wasn't what a serious person does." To his amazement, Wilkinson determined that he would vote for Obama. Even one of Obama's harshest critics was now writing off McCain. None other than Hillary Clinton was convinced that there was no stopping Obama. In the midst of the financial crisis, she said to a friend, "God wants him to win." Clinton wasn't alone in the conviction that the outcome of the race was basically settled. But October turned out to hold its own abundance of surprises, shaking the campaigns and appalling or delighting voters, depending on their inclinations. The shocks to come weren't discharged by McCain or Obama, though. Instead, the game changers of the final month were on the undercard. Chapter 22. Seconds in Command. Sarah Palin was alone in her room at the Millennium Broadway Hotel in New York, staring at her index cards. It was September 23rd, the night before McCain suspended his campaign, and Palin was scheduled to begin a series of interviews the next morning with Katie Couric. Around 9 o'clock, Nicole Wallace arrived to spend some time doing prep. Couric was sure to ask her about the financial crisis, Wallace said, showing Palin a statement that McCain had just released on the subject. "If you internalize this," Wallace explained, "you should be able to field basic questions about the bailout." Wallace knew Couric well, having worked as a political analyst at CBS between her stints at the White House and the McCain campaign. She shared her insights with Palin on other areas the anchor would almost certainly pursue, such as abortion rights. But Palin, who had spent the day meeting foreign leaders who were in Manhattan for the UN General Assembly, was exhausted and distracted. She had a hard time processing the statement on the bailout, and when Wallace tried to raise other topics, Palin would not engage. For 3 hours, the prep session went nowhere, as Palin kept downshifting into small talk. "What's Katie like?" she asked. By the eve of the Couric interviews, McCain World was nursing an array of worries about Palin, from her character to her knowledge level to her focus. With her meteoric rise had come fantastic scrutiny, and although Palin had survived so far, the chinks in her armor were becoming apparent, especially to those observing her at close range. The first signs of trouble appeared immediately after the convention, when the campaign staff began digging in a systematic way into Palin's background and noticed that she had a tendency to shade the truth. Had she really said thanks but no thanks to the Bridge to Nowhere? Well, no. Had she really sold the state jet on eBay? Not exactly. Had she and Todd really been without health insurance until he got his union card? Actually, the story was more complicated. At McCain headquarters, a white board was set up with a list of controversies the press was exploring, from Troopergate, which the Palins unvaringly called Tasergate, a reference to one of the more lurid details of the case, to the charge that, as mayor of Wasilla, Palin had sanctioned requiring women to pay for their own rape exam kits. The campaign quickly discovered that consulting her about any issue on the board invariably yielded a sanitized version of reality. Another source of concern was Palin's lack of fealty to the commitment she'd made to Schmidt and Salter the night before her selection. Palin had promised to support McCain's positions, even though she disagreed with. But one day in September, when the campaign arranged an elaborate and expensive setup for her to shoot a pro-stem cell research television ad, she showed up and refused to read her lines. "You should have sent me the script before," Palin declared. "I'm not saying this." Palin had also pledged to banish Alaska temporarily from her thoughts and concentrate on the task at hand, but she and Todd were fixated on her reputation in the state, concerned that her image was taking a beating in Alaska because of the attacks on her. They wanted the campaign to run television ads there, though Alaska was solidly Republican and money was tight in McCain world. Todd griped about how few McCain-Palin yard signs he saw when he drove around back home. Sarah voiced so much anxiety over her gubernatorial approval rating that Schmidt promised to commission a poll in Alaska to prove that her fears were groundless. Then there was the matter of Palin's substantive deficiencies. On September 10th, she was preparing to fly back to Alaska to see her son Track ship off to Iraq and to tape her first network interview with ABC News' Charlie Gibson. Before the flight to Anchorage, Schmidt, Wallace, and other members of her traveling party met Palin at the Ritz-Carlton near Reagan Airport in Pentagon City, Virginia, and found that although she'd made some progress with her memorization and studies, her grasp of rudimentary facts and concepts was minimal. Palin couldn't explain why North and South Korea were separate nations. She didn't know what the Fed did. Asked who attacked America on 9/11, she suggested several times that it was Saddam Hussein. Asked to identify the enemy that her son would be fighting in Iraq, she drew a blank. Palin's horrified advisors provided her with scripted replies, which she memorized. Later on the plane, Palin said to her team, "I wish I'd paid more attention to this stuff." But after cramming furiously, Palin managed to emerge intact from the Gibson interview, stumbling only over whether she agreed with the Bush doctrine. "In what respect, Charlie?" and in discussing why the proximity of Alaska to Russia afforded her insight into its behavior on the world stage. "They're our next-door neighbors, and you can actually see Russia from land here in Alaska." Now, with the convention and a network interview behind her, Palin had just the last of her three major hurdles left to surmount: the vice presidential debate on October 2nd at Washington University in St. Louis. It was obvious that she would need to spend much of her time on Biden prep, but McCain World believed it couldn't simply bunker Palin and have her disappear from public view. She was a star, a sensation, and the press was howling that, Gibson or no, she was being sheltered from cross-examination. Hence the decision to grant Couric a multi-part interview. As CBS promoted and unspooled the segments over the following week, Palin could go dark to study while keeping her visibility high. What no one realized was how severely Palin's bandwidth was constricted. Her roadshow is becoming a traveling circus come soap opera. Her children, a pregnant hormonal young woman, a lively teenage girl, a rambunctious child, a special needs infant, and a son just decamped for a rock, consumed a vast amount of her psychic energy. Her focus on Alaska, and especially the Alaskan media, with which she had been friendly but which she was now certain was turning against her, and her attempts to prepare for her meetings with world leaders devoured even more. One of Palin's private email accounts was hacked, and the gossip website Gawker posted messages that she'd sent, as well as Bristol's cell phone number. And on the season premiere of Saturday Night Live on September 13th, Tina Fey debuted her withering, hilarious, uncanny caricature of Palin, mocking her interview with Gibson. "I can see Russia from my house." All of this had taken a toll on Palin by the time Wallace sat down with her at the Broadway Millennium. Wallace's husband, Mark, a former Bush campaign official who was also part of Palin's team, had warned his wife about a phenomenon that he and others thought of as the two Sarahs. One minute, Palin would be her perky self. The next, she would fall into a strange blue funk. With prep going nowhere, Nicole decided it was best to put Palin in a positive state of mind. She cooed over the governor's wardrobe for the next day and said they'd get down to business again the next morning at 6 o'clock. When Wallace returned bright and early, she found Palin in a pink bathrobe, her eyes glassy and dead. The candidate was furious and embarrassed about a report in the New York Times detailing how the press had been blocked from the first few minutes of her meeting the day before with Afghani President Hamid Karzai. As hair and makeup stylists worked on Palin, Wallace ran through potential interview questions. The candidate was unresponsive. Wallace read Palin the newspaper. The candidate sat in silence. After two futile hours as they were about to set off to meet Couric, Palin announced, "I hate this makeup," smearing it off her face, messing up her hair, complaining that she looked fat. Wallace, in a panic, summoned a makeup artist to ride in the motorcade and repair the damage. On the drive across town to meet Couric at the UN, Palin could speak of little else besides the Alaska poll that Schmidt had promised, but she suspected had never been conducted. "I'm trying to trust you people," Palin said to Wallace, "but how can I trust you?" Palin and Couric greeted each other cordially and then taped the first two segments of the series, a sit-down interview and a walk-and-talk outside the UN. Everyone in earshot understood immediately the scale of the disaster. Palin's answers about the bailout were halting and incoherent. When Couric asked her to name examples of McCain's efforts to regulate the economy, Palin said, "I'll try to find some and bring them to you." Asked again about the relevance of Russia's closeness to Alaska, she replied, "As Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America, where do they go? It's Alaska." Asked to name a Supreme Court case besides Roe versus Wade that she disagreed with, Palin awkwardly hedged, "Of course, in the great history of America, there have been rulings that there's never going to be absolute consensus by every American," and then came up empty. A snippet from the interviews aired on CBS that night, but in the clamor over McCain's campaign suspension, nobody noticed. The next morning, Couric went on the network's early show to promote her exclusive, commenting mildly that Palin wasn't always responsive in replying to certain questions. At that moment, Wallace was in the middle of an appearance on Today and felt her cell phone vibrate madly. As she left NBC, she checked and saw that Palin had been calling nonstop. Soon enough, the governor called again. "Katie said I struggled to answer questions," Palin shouted. Wallace held her tongue. Palin shouted again, "Are you listening?" "I'm listening," said Wallace. "You did struggle to answer a lot of questions." "I don't know what you guys are trying to do to me," Palin fumed. "Why did you make me do Katie?" For the next 20 minutes, as Wallace walked the 13 blocks back to her apartment, Palin screamed and Wallace yelled back. "The reason the interview sucked was because you didn't try," Wallace said. "You didn't show up and you didn't fight. The reason Gibson worked out is because even if you didn't know every answer, you clawed your way through the whole thing." Wallace could barely fathom Palin's hissy fit and her attempt to blame others for her failure to prepare. Wallace had been Palin's closest confidant in McCain world, but now Nicole was through with her, and the feeling was mutual. Palin thought Wallace and McCain world had tossed her into the lioness's mouth, that Couric had been bound and determined to devour her. She wanted nothing more to do with network anchors, especially since they got in the way of her talking to Alaska reporters. "I want to do what I want to do," Palin said stubbornly to Wallace. "Now I know what Hillary meant when she said she had to find her voice." That afternoon, Palin left New York and flew to Philadelphia to spend the next week concentrating on debate prep. She and her team, led by Mark Wallace and including Tucker Eskew and Steve Bagan, checked into the Westin downtown, took over a conference room, and got to work. The next 2 days, by all accounts, were a total train wreck. Never before had Palin's team seen her so profoundly out of sorts for such a sustained period. She wasn't eating, a few small bites of steak a day, no more. She wasn't drinking, maybe half a can of Diet Dr. Pepper, no water ever. She wasn't sleeping, not much more than a couple of hours a night, max. The index cards were piling up by the hundreds, but Palin wasn't absorbing the material written on them. When her aides tried to quiz her, she would routinely shut down, chin on her chest, arms folded, eyes cast to the floor, speechless and motionless, lost in what those around her described as a kind of catatonic stupor. Some on her staff believed that Palin was suffering from postpartum depression or thwarted maternal need. Again and again she talked about Trigg, who most of the time was back in Alaska with Todd. "I miss my baby," Sarah would say. "I miss sleeping with my baby." Others pointed to the Couric interview, the second excruciating slice of which aired the Thursday night they arrived at Philly, subjecting Palin to more ridicule. Still others cited the sheer magnitude of the pressure she was under, given her oft-expressed sense of obligation not to let McCain down, an apparent fear of humiliation, and the searing scrutiny she was receiving. Wallace, with a sense of desperation setting in, tried to buck Palin up. "Sure, they were in a rough patch," he said, "but it was worth it, right?" "No," Palin said. "If I'd known everything I know now, I would not have done this." On Saturday, September 27th, Wallace sent an urgent SOS to McCain headquarters. On a call with Schmidt, Davis, and Salter, he described how Palin was performing, how dire the circumstances were, especially with the debate just 5 days away. They began discussing a new and threatening possibility, that Palin was mentally unstable. Schmidt had heard that Palin was accusing him of lying about the Alaska poll. In fact, it had been conducted. Her approval rating was in the 70s, which led him to believe that she was becoming irrational. He and Davis planned to take the train to Philadelphia the next day to assess the situation themselves. Given the acuteness of Wallace's concern, McCain's advisors felt they had to bring the candidate into the loop that Saturday. Bluntly, they described to him their unease about Palin's mental state. McCain suggested that they move the debate prep to his spread in Sedona. Give her room to breathe, let her bring her family. A change of scenery might do her good. Cindy would be there to support Palin, and a doctor friend of the McCains would be on hand to observe her. Schmidt and Davis weren't the only McCainiacs who trekked to the Westin on Sunday. Wallace also summoned Joe Lieberman to help Palin grasp elements of foreign policy and also to get an outside perspective on whether she was doing as badly as he thought. A month earlier, when McCain informed Lieberman that he'd lost out to Palin in the Veep Stakes, Lieberman had been disappointed, if unsurprised, but more confused than anything. He was so unfamiliar with Palin that he mixed her up momentarily with Linda Lingle, the Jewish Republican governor of Hawaii. After all, Sarah was a Hebrew name. Lieberman had met Palin at the St. Paul Convention and established a bit of a rapport with her, another reason for him to be at the Westin. But the Palin he saw now scarcely resembled the confident, brassy woman he'd watched bring audiences close to rapture on the trail. She was sitting there being fed questions, saying virtually nothing, to the point where her coaches asked Lieberman to take the lectern and start answering instead. Schmidt and Davis rolled in and were appalled by the scene they found. The room was hot and claustrophobic. The shades were drawn. The place was full of half-eaten hotel food and stank of moldering French fries. Palin, looking dazed, was surrounded, as usual, by stacks and stacks of index cards. Schmidt cleared the room and said to Palin, "Governor, the debate's on Thursday and this isn't working. We're going to move the show to Sedona and we're going to fix it. The Katie Couric interview did not go well, and it didn't go well because you didn't prepare. And there can never be another instance of something not going well because of that. You're not the first politician to have a bad interview. Ronald Reagan said that trees cause pollution and went on to be a great president. No one will remember this stuff if we have a good debate." Schmidt thought Palin looked thin and drawn. "Your road crew tells me that you're not sleeping," he said. "No one running for the office of vice president should be getting less than 8 hours of sleep a night. If you need to take sleeping pills, you should." Schmidt then brusquely brought up Palin's weight. "It's my understanding that you might be on the Atkins diet," he said. That goofy diet is bad for you. I want you off it today. I'm alarmed by your weight loss, and it's noticeable even in just a couple weeks. In order to perform at your highest level, you have to have a balanced diet. Palin agreed to it all. When Schmidt finished, he walked out in the hall and buttonholed Lieberman. She's down, Schmidt said. This whole process is affecting her confidence. Lieberman couldn't have agreed more, although he wasn't sure that having a former VP nominee show off his debating chops was the best way to build Palin up. The situation was wildly unconventional already. A Democratic senator being imported into a top-secret lockdown to assist a Republican vice presidential candidate whose mental stability was in question. Now Schmidt asked Lieberman to perform another unorthodox intervention. "You're both very religious," Schmidt said. "Go in there and pray with her." As it happened, Palin had already been prayed for that day. A group of Republican congresswomen had offered their blessings via conference call with her, but Lieberman went back and took a less direct tack, providing Palin with Talmudic wisdom. Invoking the influential Orthodox rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, he spoke about the covenant of faith, which is the relationship between God and man, and the covenant of destiny, which is what men make of themselves. "Look," Lieberman said kindly, "you got to be saying to yourself, what am I doing here? How did this happen? This is your moment to make it really count for something." Palin seemed touched. "Joe," she said, "I can't figure any other reason I'm here except that I was meant to be here." Palin's immediate rendezvous with destiny was in Ohio the next day, where she stopped on the way to Sedona to join McCain for a rally and to tape the final parts of her interview with Couric. Palin wanted to blow off Katie, but the campaign felt that doing so would be a PR nightmare. Palin acquiesced, but not entirely. Rather than prepping for Couric, she allowed herself to become consumed by a different media opportunity, a questionnaire from the Mat-Su Valley Frontiersman, the local Wasilla newspaper, which she insisted on filling out herself. Hours before she was scheduled to meet Couric, Palin emailed several members of her team. "How about I do the Katie interview after I get the Frontiersman interview questions and reply to them? It's been my priority." The irony was rich, therefore, when the question of Couric's that tripped up Palin that day was one about her reading habits. What newspapers and magazines did she read to stay abreast of the world? "Most of them," Palin said. "Specifically?" "All of them. Any of them that have been in front of me all these years." "Can you name a few?" "I have a vast variety of sources where we get our news, too," Palin said. "Alaska isn't a foreign country." Debate camp commenced that night in Sedona with an outdoor buffet hosted by Cindy. Palin was thrilled to see her family and spent much of the time cradling Trigg, but beyond that, she was subdued. To prevent leaks about the ongoing crisis, Schmidt had drastically narrowed the circle around Palin, cutting out much of her staff and foregoing the idea of a professional politician to stand in for Biden.